Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are always privileged to have the intelligence and to benefit from the sense of intelligence of a former undercover CIA operative, Charles Sam Faddis, and is just one of the ways in which he has served our country. He's also, interestingly enough, been a former assistant attorney general in the state of Washington. He has contributed mightily to the public policy debate about all manner of things, including through his books, notably Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency, and his output, which is simply astounding, at andmagazine.com. I hope you'll check it out. Sam, it's good to have you back. Welcome for fitting this in today. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I'm particularly interested in something I touch on in my commentary today, Sam, which I know you're tracking closely, as you have been. The events began last summer with rioting and pandemonium, including bloodletting by Black Lives Matter organization and its partners in crime, Antifa. And this arises in connection with the possibility that we may see them on the march again with violent outcomes, perhaps in Minneapolis and maybe other parts of the country, in connection with a trial that is just about to get underway involving this fellow Derek Chauvin, a former police officer accused of having murdered George Floyd. Talk a bit about what you think is in the offing here and whether some of those who are supposed to be responsible for preventing this sort of thing may be taking steps that actually will impel it.
Right. So Chauvin is the guy who everybody famously remembers was videotaped kneeling on George Floyd's neck before he died. He's been charged. Jury selection starts today. Got second-degree murder charges, second-degree manslaughter charges, maybe some others against him. A whole army of groups in Minneapolis, supported by organizations across the country, are organizing not just to protest this, but to be prepared to take whatever action, depending on how this trial runs out. That's been ramping up already. Major marches and so forth took place last night. As you suggested, what we have here is a situation where there is some significant question whether Chauvin should be or will be convicted of anything, and primarily because press reports indicate that the toxicology reports on George Floyd suggest that he died from a fentanyl overdose, meaning that there would be, in fact, legally no connection between the police action and his demise, which means you're not going to convict him of any form of homicide of any kind. But
and the fentanyl in his bloodstream, as I understand it, may have contributed to why Chauvin was using this technique, which actually had up to that point been approved in police, you know, practices to restrain a big and violent individual. Is that not correct?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, obviously, that's the whole point of the trial here is to get to the bottom of this. So I'm not prejudging that, but that is a very significant possibility that you're going to find out that what appeared to be a guy being killed by having his airway cut off, somebody kneeling on it, that's not what happened here at all. And so what you have is a city that already burned once. I mean, the level of violence in Minneapolis before, when they lost an entire police precinct back in May, was really off the charts. It is now, if anything, primed to go up at an even bigger explosion. The state, if you will, the government has charged this police officer and said they think he's responsible, meaning even though they know about these toxicology reports, meaning that you have the very real possibility that you're going to have a jury, or maybe it'll never get to a jury, a judge, throw out this case Chauvin walks, and you have set all the conditions for an explosion because, and this is very similar, by the way, to what we saw in Baltimore with the whole thing a few years ago there, where they charged X number of cops in the Freddie Gray situation. And the prosecutor, despite the fact that it was very clear that the evidence wasn't there for a conviction, went ahead with it so that the prosecutor was off the hook and looked when she was playing to the crowd and set the city up for this explosion of violence when the inevitable happened.
In this case, we have an attorney general in Minnesota who has taken this case under his jurisdiction and who has a very problematic background, it seems to me. His name is Keith Ellison. He is a very, very pronounced leftist, chaired the Progressive Caucus, as it's called, in the House of Representatives before he was elected to this job, and has documented ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, and was famously seen, you know, brandishing a book that was laudatory about Antifa back when he was running, actually, for this job. Could this, again, you have a personal track record in law enforcement at the state level. Could he have done this in a manner, whether it's intentional or not, that could have contributed to this problem, Sam Pattis, of a violent outcome afflicting a city and perhaps others like it around the country once again?
Yeah, without question. And you've touched on a number of important points there. First of all, if Minneapolis explodes, which at this point is extremely, extremely likely, this will not be confined to Minneapolis. You will see instantaneously this will happen all across the country. And pretty much everything that what I call the corporate media has said about this kind of violence for a year now, at least, is a lie. You know, that this is mostly peaceful protest. Okay, that's not true. That it's disorganized, that there's nobody putting this together. That's not true.
So talk a bit more about that, Sam, because you've studied what's going on here for months now. What is the nature of the organization that seems to be poised at this moment, as they were previously, to exploit any pretext to go back on rampaging in our cities?
Well, I mean, to the extent that they're not organized means there is no central headquarters that controls all activity that happens in the United States. I suppose, arguably, that's a fair characterization. That doesn't change the fact that there are a whole universe of groups out there with Marxist ideologies, getting money from all sorts of leftist sources, including at some point communist Chinese sources, and all of them have an agenda which is expressly Marxist. Now, that doesn't mean every person who marches in every march is necessarily on board with that ideology. Some of them may be well-intentioned and think that all they're participating in is a peaceful protest. But writ large, that is not at all what is happening here. And that's not the objective in Minneapolis.
Sam, unfortunately, we are out of time. You've written a powerful book about Beyond Repair concerning the CIA. I think that's true of the FBI as well. And it's very worrying to me that under the leadership of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who have been either AWOL on all of this or actually sympathizing with it, we're likely to see very little help coming from the federal authorities. But we'll be watching this closely, as I know will you at endmagazine.com. Come back to us with updates, please, as soon as possible. And thank you for your time today, my friend. It's good to talk with you. Next up, we'll talk a bit about China with Dr. Bradley Thayer, one of our country's preeminent experts on the subject, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and I'm pleased to extend a very special welcome to a wonderful contributor to this program. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a professor of political science at the University of Texas in San Antonio. He is the author of numerous books, including most recently, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Bradley Thayer, it's good to have you back. You are also a valued member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and we appreciate your contributions to it as well as to this program. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. My pleasure.
Well, it's time for a little stock-taking on what you think the Biden administration is up to with respect to China. We had this very peculiar 2-hour phone call, Joe Biden and the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping. Joe Biden hasn't been known to do 2 hours of anything of late, other than, I think, nap. What do you think was said in the course of that epic conversation, even discounting some time for translation? I have to say it's remarkable, and I worry about what Joe Biden might have said, and, well, for that matter, what Xi probably told him as well. Your thoughts?
Well, thank you, Frank. I that was a very important phone call, and it would be very nice to see the transcript, and I hope at some point we're able to review it in full. There are two points that strike me. First is that the length of the call, as you observed, even accounting for translation, meant that there were meaty topics discussed. And I would imagine they certainly centered on some economic issues, but also some security issues as well, and human rights concerns, I would hope. Second point to consider with respect to that call is that Joe Biden's abilities to, as you observed, to focus on that, of course, are worrisome, that Biden does not seem to be at the height of his faculties, and to engage in a conversation with Xi Jinping, the leader of the Communist Party of China and a formidable foe, perhaps the most formidable foe the United States has ever faced, is a cause of a considerable concern. And I would add that it's not just many in the U.S. who are worried about this issue, but our allies as well. Right, the Japanese, of course, the Taiwanese, Australians, many states throughout international politics and groups. For example, the Uyghurs in East Turkestan or Xinjiang, and Kazakh Muslims and Kyrgyz Muslims, of course, would be have a vested interest in that. The Tibetan minority, of course, which is oppressed by the Communist Party of China. And in Hong Kong, just to name a few, I think the salient actors who would have a stake in any conversation. So it would be very useful if they released that information so that we could see just what was exchanged between the two leaders.
I don't think it's advisable to hold our breath on this, even though the Democratic political machine was in a full lather at the conversations that Donald Trump had with Vladimir Putin, and were very insistent on, you know, having the transcripts of those. I don't think that the White House is going to release this one, but you're a serious student of the U.S.-China relationship, Brad. And the thing that worries me as much as anything is what may have been telegraphed, even if it was inadvertent, by Joe Biden, that might give rise on the part of this thug, Xi Jinping, and I think that's what we have to understand he is, as evidence that they will have their way with the United States under the Biden presidency, that not only is he personally deeply compromised, as she certainly understands, but that the willingness to resist what China seeks, whether it's in Hong Kong or whether it's in Taiwan or whether it's with respect to the Uyghurs or perhaps the Belt and Road Initiative and who knows what all else, may well prompt, perhaps on the basis of a miscalculation, aggressive behavior on the part of the Chinese Communist Party. What do you think?
That is a cause of great concern, that if the Chinese believe that they have a window of opportunity because the present administration seeks to return to a period of accommodation with China rather than measured confrontation as the Trump administration advanced. That's a very worrisome development. The Chinese might believe that they have a window of opportunity, and they are bold at being able to metastatically really push up against U.S. interests, take over, supplant U.S. interests in other Western states globally. So it's a cause of great concern. And the accommodation does not work. We had decades of accommodating the growth of the People's Republic of China. And for the United States, that only resulted in our greatest grand strategic failure, the rise of a peer competitor, again, who arose with our cooperation by allowing that entity into our economic ecosystem and our political ecosystems.
I worry it's more than that, in the sense that we wound up actually underwriting much of that rise of China, and still do. Even People's Liberation Army companies, for heaven's sake, can get money out of our capital markets, at least for the time being, from the Biden team. Let me ask you about a piece that you and your co-author Liangqiao Han wrote in a recent essay in the Hill newspaper, in which you talked about the fact that China traps the U.S. into negotiations and then breaks its promises. This does seem to be a hardy perennial of Chinese diplomacy, unfortunately under Republican as well as Democratic administrations, particularly during this engagement period that you've just described, Brad. Talk a bit about the concern here and the dangers associated with it.
Certainly. The Chinese are greatly concerned that the United States can take action against them to prevent their rise. And so they're greatly worried about time. And they use a variety of tactics to distract, if you will, the American and Western national security communities. One of their favorite tactics is to promise negotiations, where they draw out, extend, and lengthen, of course, the possibility of negotiations, because they understand a Western mindset very well, that we seek negotiation, we seek to build relationships with states, and advance mutual interests. Well, that has become a weakness for the United States and other Western states, and has allowed the Chinese to draw out and thus prevent any effective balancing against them. And they've done that for decades, and they continue to do so. So negotiations with the Chinese communists have to be certainly very sensitive to time. And that is that if you are going into negotiations, which is perhaps fundamentally unwise to do in the first place, but if you choose to do so, then you want to have a very tight limit in terms of the time frame that you're considering. That's absolutely essential, because if not, they will continue to do what they have done, which is to distract us while they rise, and thus prevent our steps that we can take to prevent their rise. They're still in a period of vulnerability.
Yeah, but Brad, the point that you make as well in this piece is, even if time were not, you know, a consideration working against us and working for them, if they can buy time at our expense. But it also is the case that there aren't any agreements that one can think of, are there, that actually produce desirable or at least sustained beneficial results for the United States. I'm thinking, among other things, of this Phase One agreement as just the most recent one that the Trump administration settled for after protracted negotiations. But in the end, the main upshot of it seems to have been that we wound up, going back to what we were just talking about a moment ago, enabling Wall Street firms to open up wholly owned subsidiaries in China for the purpose of transferring still more American investments thither, and to our great detriment.
Indeed, we're still hemorrhaging, Frank, and that's the Trump administration took measures against that, and it does not seem that the Biden administration will. So that's a very great danger to us. To your points, first, the Chinese are communists, right? Which is, and communists will do anything to advance their own interests. They will enter into a treaty or a negotiation tactically. As Lenin said, treaties are pie crusts, right? They're made to be broken. So it's just a question of when they're going to break it. They have no desire to sustain and to develop regimes or norms that might surround trade negotiations or arms control negotiations or other areas. So because they are communists, any negotiation is going to be tactical and serve their own interests. And more so, they'll seek to lull us into it, as we described before, to prevent our effective balancing against them. So we need to steer clear. There have been, as you observe, right, if we look at the scope of negotiations, treaties, et cetera, with China, there have been very, very few that have served U.S. interests. And in fact, the Chinese have demonstrated that they will break those agreements with the U.S. as they broke the 1984 agreement with Britain over Hong Kong, where they pledged Hong Kong's essentially political autonomy for a significant period of time after 1997 when they regained control of that former colony. So that has to be a caveat which governs our national security community, which governs our diplomacy and those of our allies. I think many of our allies see that more clearly.
I hope so. I have to say, Brad, it seems as though it's a bit of a mixed bag. Some of them are perfectly prepared to sell their souls, it seems, to the Chinese. And I'm thinking of particularly some of the Europeans. We're out of time, Brad. We have to come back to you for the next thought, and we will soon, I hope. And thank you for your time today, as well as for your important book about Han centrism, How China Sees the World, Han Centrism and the Balance of Power in International Politics. Check it out, folks. Brad, we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you very much for your time today. Next up, we'll talk with retired Lieutenant General Stephen Quast, a bit more about China and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And I'm always delighted to be able to say welcome to our next guest. His name is Lieutenant General Stephen Quast, United States Air Force retired. He has served his country with great distinction, including as a combat pilot in a number of places, including Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Southern Watch, and Enduring Freedom. He's logged more than 3,300 hours in the cockpit, including a fair amount of that in combat. He finished up his distinguished time in uniform as the commander of the VAST, Air Education and Training Command of the United States Air Force at Joint Base San Antonio. And he is a good friend as well as a very admired military leader, and we're always delighted to have a chance to chat with him here at Secure Freedom Radio. General, thank you, Jen, for joining us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Frank. I appreciate the opportunity.
I particularly am keen to talk to you because during your time at the Air Training Command and San Antonio, you were really leading on the importance of understanding the threats the country faces, both the military and the civilian communities, from threats in the electromagnetic spectrum. And that included real threats to our electrical grid. There has, of course, been tremendous dislocation and hardship wrought as a result of the grid going down much of Texas, including San Antonio, in recent weeks. And I wanted to have you visit, if you would, with us a bit about both the macro problem that represents and what we can do about it, including something that you set in train during your time there in the San Antonio community.
Well, thank you, Frank. And you're exactly right. As a warfighter, as a person dedicated to defending this country, I understand that you're only as strong as your weakest link. And in our society, we require energy to grow our economy and to provide security. So as a military officer, a commanding general of multiple bases, I am only as strong as those bases are resilient. And, so in San Antonio, we realized that we on the base were dependent on the downtown power grid, water systems, information systems, and we decided to try to make that more resilient, because not only are those susceptible to Mother Nature, as we saw unfold in Texas in the last month, but they are also susceptible to an enemy who is now within our borders. Because of our open society, which we always want to keep, the reality is that because of the modality of humanity across the globe, the enemy can be within, and our information, our energy, and our water systems are very fragile. So to that end, we were lucky enough in San Antonio to have a mayor in Mayor Ron Nuremberg, and in a power company, CPS Power, and a governor in Abbott, who were willing to partner with us in the military. And now the program, which is called the Electromagnetic Defense Initiative, is a program supported by the Department of Energy, Department of Homeland Security, and Department of Defense. And it is trying out all the new technologies to make our power grid and our water systems and our information systems resilient to Mother Nature and to a potential enemy.
This was really important, and it seems to me has become more so, of course, with recent events. How is that progressing, General? Are you seeing the team continuing to proceed?
Yes, it is. It's growing, and people are starting to recognize that this is actually very affordable to build into the system strategic design for resilience. So I'm very encouraged. More and more of the government, it is now a blue chip program for the White House. So it is becoming really evident, and the storm recently just punctuated that we have to invest in resilient infrastructure in this country, specifically energy, water, and information.
When you say a blue chip program for the administration, do you mean the Biden-Harris administration?
No, it was put in place by the Trump administration, and but it's once it's put in place, it stays in place, and nobody has deleted it because it's so impactful. This is about bringing the utilities and the essentials for our population that the government is accountable for.
Well, you say nobody changes things. Unfortunately, one of the, you talked about the enemy within being a problem. The Biden-Harris administration has suspended, temporarily at least, an executive order that Donald Trump promulgated about preventing foreign equipment from being placed in our grid, hostile powers at that. And yet we've discovered in the aftermath of this decision by the Biden administration that the Chinese have between 200 and 300 high-voltage transformers in our electric grid system. Again, as a serious strategic thinker and military practitioner, how serious a problem is that?
So this is where the American people need to pay attention and watch and learn and understand what's going on. And the American people need to demand of their political leaders that those things that are so precious to us can only be run and operated by people who we trust. You would never let your child be babysat by somebody who has a record of kidnapping your child. And so when we think about the power grid, that power grid can only be touched and operated by people we trust so deeply that we know they have the American best interest in mind. We have not seen that track record with China. The American people need to be the ones that are vocal about this and say, not on my watch will I have somebody touch my electricity, my energy, my information, and my water by a civilization that has demonstrated a lack of good faith in dealing with other people fairly.
Yeah, well, particularly a Chinese Communist Party that is all about that, that's for sure. General Kwas, let me turn to one other topic with you quickly. Speaking of China, you have, in the course of your military service and now post-service activities, been very clear-eyed about the threat that China represents in one other domain, and that is space. Could you just quickly characterize how serious a problem it is that China's doctrine seems to be to not only have access to and use of space, but to be able to deny it to us?
Yeah, so this is something if the American people have not been reading and watching, they need to realize that this is equivalent to the British Empire building deep sea ships, sails, and dominating the global oceans with commerce and being able to be so powerful they can deny everybody else access to the seas. This is what China is planning on doing with space. They are building an armada in space that will be able to travel between the Earth and the Moon and beyond. And such power that they could deny any other country on Earth from doing the same. They plan on dominating the global economy, just like England dominated the global economy using the oceans. China plans on doing the same with space. And they've written about it. They've talked about it. It is their national vision.
And more to the point, it is being executed now, it seems, systematically, is it not? And just talk a little bit about it. About ways in which it's manifesting itself from, you know, some kind of operation on the dark side of the moon to the increasing launching of equipment and material into space, apparently now to build a new large space station there. Lagrange points that are strategically of such importance, and missions to Mars even.
Yeah, so I'll frame it out this way so that all your listeners can connect it with things that have happened before that are understandable. You say Lagrange points, and many people will say, what's that? Well, think of in space, the Lagrange points are the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, and the Straits of Malacca that we know as the terrestrial point of strategic relevance. So if China control, they're choke, they're choke points for even more powerful reason, even those three on the planet that we can talk about later. But what China is planning on doing, you see their activity on the far side of the moon. That is so that they can operate around all the moon and all the Earth, and they are not trapped in an orbit where they're just falling in a predictable manner. They want to be able to do three things cheaper and faster than any other country on the planet, and that is they want to be able to communicate anywhere in the orbits around the moon and the sun and never be blocked by a celestial body. So they have all kinds of space vehicles out there. They won't even be in orbit around the moon or the Earth. They will be in space, not even trapped by the gravity, in order to communicate. Then they want to be able to project power, meaning energy. So you can see in the next 10 years, they will have nuclear power stations in space and power beaming stations in space using solar power and nuclear power. And this will allow them to energize any vehicle in space, but it also can be used as a weapon of mass destruction in a millisecond to provide the kind of laser and or directed energy to kinetically kill or paralyze anything that works with electricity. And so you can see how their plan that has been unfolding for the last 30 years, like clockwork, consistent with their vision and their milestones. They are on a march to have all of these things in place by 2049 to dominate the global economy in these three areas: transportation, energy, and information.
And this could actually happen considerably before then, given the pace that they're currently on and their determination to get there first, as you say, in all of these regards. General Quast, you have been a leader on the Space Force idea and trying to help realize its potential to give us a shot at successfully competing with the Chinese in space and protecting our vital interests there and from there on the Earth as well. We salute you for all of that and look forward to further updates with you as we watch these developments on the grid and with respect to the space contest continue to unfold. God bless you, sir. Appreciate all your service to our country, including that you are rendering these days at Genesis Systems. And thank you for your time today, sir. Next up, we'll speak with a leader of the conservative movement, our weekly visit with Bill Walton, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's time for our weekly visit with one of the leaders of the conservative movement in the United States. His name is William Walton. He is the president of the Council for National Policy, a job that he has taken on following a very successful career in Wall Street and some time in the public policy arena, notably with his podcast television program, The Bill Walton Show. And it's always good to have a chance to catch up with him. Bill, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, Frank. Great talking with you.
I wanted to visit with you again, Bill, because we've had a development since we last talked about a piece of legislation that I think we agree is very, very dangerous indeed. It was known as H.R. 1 in the House of Representatives, the so-called For the People Act. It has a similar priority and designation in the Senate, S-1. Talk a bit about this legislation and what we are looking at now that the House of Representatives has, on a basically strict party line vote, approved it.
Well, what we're seeing is extraordinary, but not at all surprising. Something like only 20-25% of Americans think the last two elections, last presidential elections, were fairly decided. The Democrats didn't think Hillary won and thought Hillary won, and then then this time we feel pretty strongly that Trump won this. But nobody believes the election process was fair. They all felt it was rigged. And so Americans feel this way. And what do the Democrats do? Well, they gin up H.R. 1, now S. 1, which essentially passes into federal law all the bad stuff we saw in the November election.
That's the thing that's so worrying about this is, Bill, that it would essentially allow, indeed, enshrine, mandate a whole series of steps that now increasingly, I think it's obvious, contributed to electoral fraud and larceny.
Yeah, well, let me just tick off some of the stuff they want to do. They want to ban states from requiring photo IDs before people vote. They want to make it illegal for states to remove voters from the voter registration list after the election, which means all sorts of dead people and all sorts of people that didn't exist in the first place would stay on. And they want to allow mail-in ballots for up to 10 days after the election. Well, on the other hand, Americans, if you ask them, I think 75% favor a national holiday so people can vote same day on election day.
One day, hopefully, in paper ballots in person with voter ID and, you know, fewer and fewer of these opportunities for fraud and other shenanigans. Bill, let me just say that should this go to a vote in the Senate, which seems very likely, one of the key questions is going to be, will Republicans who, as I understand it, are unanimously opposed, be able to deny the 60 votes that are required for a consideration of this particular piece of legislation. The key guy in whether that filibuster procedure will apply or not is Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing by him, including appearances on, I think, all of the Sunday shows this weekend about his attitude on the filibuster. What do you make of his position and what does it portend?
Well, I don't think we can count on Joe Manchin. Every time a vote counted, the Republicans thought he might swing to, he's voted with the Democrats. And I don't see him. He loves the limelight of being the guy that people think he loves being the supposed kingmaker, but he always votes the wrong way. So we really can't count on him. And, you know, this is an extremely, you know, this gets Americans into all this stuff that we don't really want to know about, which is the filibuster and the Byrd rule. And, you know, they need a 51 vote majority, simple majority to pass many legislation, but not this one because of the provisions in it. They need 60. So the question is, do the Democrats finally get rid of the filibuster, which requires 60, or do something with the Byrd rule? The smart people I've talked to think maybe this one big bill won't get passed, but it'll get broken up into smaller pieces, and they'll try to accomplish the same thing through other pieces of legislation. Yeah, it's important to remember that most Americans, when they voted for Joe Biden, did not vote for this stuff. And the Democrats know they've got 18 months or so until the 2022 midterms. And I think if they continue on this pace with all the stuff they're putting into practice, I think they're going to get clobbered. But maybe they won't get clobbered if they change the election rules so that they control the process. I'm laughing, but there may never be another free election if they get away with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Which makes, you know, it absolutely vital that we see this process continue to be governed by a supermajority requirement. Let me turn to one other fellow who very much likes the limelight, that would be Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York. Until very recently, he was regarded as a heavy contender for, you know, higher political office. I think some were seeing him as a future presidential candidate. He certainly did. He's run into some serious headwinds in all of that, I think it's fair to say. We've been hearing a lot about his seeming predatory sexual practices towards some of his subordinates, Bill. But there's a much bigger problem that seems to be being obscured by all of that. Talk us through what's going on here. And is there something familiar about how this is being handled?
Oh, there is something so familiar. If you recollect, and here in Virginia, Ralph Northam was on the abortion issue, partial term abortion, was quoted as saying, well, what would you do with these babies if they're born and the mother didn't want them? I said, well, we'd have a conversation with them before we'd kill it, or words to that effect. And that was just egregious. And I think would have taken him out of office. And instead, they switched the subject to him wearing blackface, which I think was a way to deflect attention from the really bad.
Or a KKK hood. It was a little unclear which of those horrors he was associated with. But this was back when he was in school, I gather.
KKK was a very big problem in 1925, in 1965, but certainly not now. Yeah, so they changed the subject, and Cuomo seems to be doing the same thing. I mean, what he did that is damnable is he allowed forced 15,000 elderly people back into nursing homes, which are a toxic environment for COVID-19. And as a result of his decision, they died. And then furthermore, he covered it up almost in real time. So you've got the double thing of the crime, and then what's worse politically is the cover-up. And so he's engaged in massive cover-up, and now he's over here, trying to entice the Me Too movement into this, and I think it's a deception.
Fantastically interesting thought. I'm a little unclear what the numbers were. I think that he may have put some number of sick people back in those institutions, and large numbers of others who were not sick died as a result of it. But your point is that really the crime was bad, but the cover-up was, again, as is often the case, worse. And so now he's being investigated, I think, by both state and federal authorities for the criminal activity of covering up these murders. And perhaps he's finding it expedient to have everybody, chasing off after his, insensitive conduct towards women, including some of those employed by him. But your point, Bill, and this is something that I think a lot of us on the conservative side face every day, and that is this deflection, which is often accompanied by projection by the left, that whatever it is they're doing, they assign to their political opponents. And it's just infuriating, really, isn't it, that typically they get away with it because not least of a compliant press.
Well, and he knows that, when politicians are accused of sexual abuse or sexual harassment, that most people think about the old Humphrey Bogart movie where somebody comes in, he's in a casino and says, I'm shocked, people are gambling here. Cuomo's gone to the...
And was subsequently presented with his winnings, as I recall.
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is very reminiscent indeed. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today. As always, it's great to have a chance to visit with you, and we'll look forward to doing so both here and, of course, on our television program, Securing America, in the hours to come. God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.